You're about to listen to a special Kilometre Zero episode from the Cycling Podcast. Now, these are usually reserved for friends of the podcast, but since the start of the Giro d'Italia is always a very special occasion for us, we're giving this gift to those who are not yet friends, but may hopefully want to become one. It's also a chance to remind you that by signing up as a friend, you're facilitating our annual on-the-ground coverage of races like the Giro, which is now in its 10th year. Our coverage, not the Giro, that is. You can become a friend for as little as £35 a year by going to thecyclingpodcast.com and clicking on the Become a Friend link. You'll thereby gain access to new special episodes like this one every month, plus a back catalogue of more than 300 exclusive episodes. We've got two more, incidentally, coming in the next few days. Now it's time for Land of Eagles.
You're listening to a Girovagando Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast.
When late in 2024, long-mooted rumours of a 2025 Giro d'Italia Grande Partenza from Albania began to gather momentum. The first challenge of my and the Cycling Podcast annual May expedition immediately took shape. Last year, we foregrounded the Giro start in Turin with the tragic story of the Grande Torino football team and the 75th anniversary of the Superga air disaster. In 2025, I wanted to find something else, maybe a similar historical hook. And now I had my canvas or subject. Albania and cycling, though, do not exactly go hand in glove. I could remember one Albanian cyclist riding the Giro, Eugur Djupa, who I'd interviewed in 2016, and in fact nearly won a stage in that race, but had retired from cycling 3 years later.
No, mio papà è arrivato col peschereggio clandestino e poi.
My dad came to Italy illegally, hidden in a fishing boat. Eventually he found work, and that meant he could get the necessary papers to bring my mum, my sister and me over. Before that though, for a few months, he literally had to hide from the authorities. My mum's been here years and speaks okay Italian, if we're being kind. My dad's the same. I'm the opposite. My Reggio Emilia dialect is better than my Albanian. I think the prejudices there were towards Albanian immigrants in Italy, and still are understandable. When the Italians went to America, they were hated too. It's a fact of life that you encounter discrimination when you go into someone else's home. You get blamed for everything. Plus, with Albania, you also have the problem of a very different mentality. Now it's becoming a bit more like Italy, but the Albanians are teste dure. They've got hard heads, as we say in Italy.
In 2016, Djupa had told me that he felt at least as Italian as he did Albanian, so I doubted whether revisiting his story would penetrate too much of the mystique around a country about which I know very little. My closest encounter with Albanian culture had in fact come at another Giro in 2017, when to our surprise and delight, after stage 6 to Terme Lugiane, we found ourselves staying in Civita, an ancient and minuscule Albanian enclave in the mountains of Calabria.
Good morning, my name is Giacomo, I'm from Civita. Civita is Arbres Italian community.
Civita is an Albanian settlement in that it was created in 1472 when refugees fled Albania, which was then under the control of the Turks, and made a new home here. The language we speak here is Arbresh, which is basically 15th century Albanian. The Albanian influence is still really strong.
Evidently, there was a lot about Albania, its history, culture and politics that I had to learn. And so I immediately got to work, scouring the travel writing shelves of a London bookshop. Even there, Albania was poorly represented, but one tome immediately caught my eye. The Accursed Mountains, Journeys in Albania by Robert Carver. In the spring and summer of 1996, British travel writer Robert Carver managed to make a series of remarkable journeys through remote and extraordinary Albania in the brief interregnum between communism and anarchy, read the blurb on the back cover, alongside an even more promising quote from a reviewer. A dazzling account of a journey, always bizarre, often comic and increasingly nightmarish, through one of the most dangerous backwaters currently to be found anywhere. Happily, it turned out to be all of this and more, an engrossing, funny and polemical yarn, so much so that I even mentioned it on the podcast once the Albanian Grande Partenza was finally confirmed. Alas, the only mountains the Giro will visit lie due south of Tirana, hundreds of kilometres from the paradisiacal, until recently largely unexplored range that gave Carver the title of his book, and whose name, the Accursed Mountains, turns out to be shrouded in contradictory mythologies, apparently a lot like Albania and its history. On page 9, to my delight, Carver describes sharing a train carriage on the sleeper from Athens towards the Albanian border with a champion cyclist, the 1987 Tour of Albania winner Agron Tafilitsa, no less. Wikipedia later helped me to establish that Tafilitsa had in fact won his national tour not once but three times, and in the 70s, not the 80s. But that minor inaccuracy hardly seemed to matter. Any idea, any germ of something, anything that I could link back to the Giro d'Italia was happily received. Real serendipity was also about to strike. A few days after I mentioned Carver and the Accursed Mountains on the podcast, I received a direct message on Twitter. I could immediately see that the correspondent had written to me before. His first missive was dated August 2019. It read, "Hi Daniel, I need to cycle between Zurich and Trieste. Google gives me two options, one via Trento and one via Brunico. I don't know enough about Northern Italy. Would the second option be appreciably quieter? The former option, of course, allows a detour up the Umbral and down the Stelvio. Any advice appreciated?" The vaguest, dimmest memory, which I jogged further by rereading the exchange that had ensued. My correspondent was called Bene, was of unspecified nationality or age, and didn't really say where ultimately was his destination or for what reason. He did, though, send me updates on his journey over the next few days, sometimes also asking for further route advice. The last flurry of messages arrived in my DMs on August the 17th. They featured a photo of a majestic ibex with the words, "Took an 8-hour hike / scree run to Monte Pramaggiore at 2,478 metres. Shared only with this guy. Totally worth it. Into Roglic country. Thank you, Italy." After that, there had been nothing. I had no idea what had become of Bene and, as you can and he would understand, hadn't particularly dwelled on our exchange. Now though, suddenly, in January 2025, here he was again, back in my inbox. All because of that cursory mention of my Christmas reading material. If this in itself was surprising, it was nothing compared to what I was about to read. "Dear Daniel, I'm not sure if 5.5 years after our previous conversation people are still looking at Twitter direct messages, but it's worth a shot. Quite ridiculously, I consider myself to be still on the above ride, with whose journey through Italy you helped me all those years ago. I got to Albania in January of 2020, and spending a month finding second-hand Shimano replacement parts in Tirana took me into the pandemic window. I chose to wait it out, which in a completely foreign country not far removed from communism was a very vivid experience. Once the quarantines were lifted but borders were open, stifled by the city, I fled to the Alps, or Accursed Mountains as you mentioned. Because mountains are life. By the time I had waited months and then years for the vaccines that would allow me to cycle onto Greece, I had adopted all the street dogs in my new village, and I couldn't face leaving them behind to uncertain fates. It has been a life-changing, at times wrenching, mostly beautiful experience here. I am told by the locals here that I know this area of the mountains better than any of them, since I've hiked almost everywhere, most days, for the last 4 years. There isn't any hiking or mountain infrastructure here, so I've literally found my own paths and discovered what there is to be discovered myself. Because my community is so rural, I've had to have a fact-finding mindset throughout. I've never just been able to live like a Brit abroad." The message didn't end there. There were another three paragraphs and more vague but tantalising details about how this had all happened. It was all quite baffling but also fascinating. Especially for someone like me who, if I'm honest, is perhaps still covering this sport and particularly the Grand Tours mainly because they're a proxy for my own dreams of adventure. I'd always intended to make contact in Albania and the Albanian cycling scene before setting off for the Grande Partenza, but now this had landed in my lap. Bene also mentioned that if he had indeed stayed in Albania for the last 5 years, it was partly thanks to the hospitality and friendship of the Albanian national cycling team coach, a gentleman he referred to as Nini. Bene wrote near the bottom of his note, "If you looked into one story while you're covering the Grande Partenza, it would be his." By this point, I didn't need much convincing. Finding a mutually convenient time for a Zoom call was a little more difficult. Bene said that where he lived, there was next to no internet. He had to go to a friend's restaurant to pick up and reply to my messages. When he did, and before we had even talked, he showered me with links to glorious chapters in Albanian cycling history, but also to embarrassing ones like the 2023 National Championships, which were marred by allegations of riders hiding in forests, routes changed mid-race, some without warning to suit certain riders, and which ended with the best Albanian rider of recent years, Yilba Sefa, more or less declaring war on his national federation. In his book, Carver quoted an English journalist, a certain T. Barber, in 1993, calling Albania the sort of place that made surrealists weep for joy. At this stage, I knew next to nothing about what awaited us in May, but I already had a sense of what Barber had meant. I suspected my call with Bene might demystify and explain some things while also adding further layers of intrigue, and I'd be more or less right. We finally set a time and date in the last week of January.
No, it's okay. It's a head torch.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I'm just fascinated by your story. So, the story that you sort of summarized for me in the direct message, and yep. I'd quite like to make a whole episode about what happened to you. But anyway, but we could see.
The good news was that Bene had enough internet connection for me to see him clearly on the screen. That was thanks to a head torch which provided the only lighting where he'd logged on. From what I could tell was a sort of cave or cellar under his friend's restaurant, or in the rafters above it. The first subject to be broached or obstacle to be overcome was Bene's reticence. He didn't think his story was especially interesting. Plus, of course, he wasn't Albanian.
Thank you, but I'm not Albanian, so like I don't really see why I'm in any way interesting to people who are tuning into the Giro for what it's going to show about Albania. That like I wish I could give you a story of somebody from here. I mean, I've met so many fascinating people from here, but most of their stories involve immigration. It's mostly people who've done drastic things to get out of here.
We came to a compromise. I'd be the judge of what was or wasn't worth putting into a podcast and give him the right to veto, if he'd rather act as a conduit to other more suitable interview candidates. Fortunately, later on, he'd kindly acquiesce. We could indeed tell his story, or rather share what he was about to tell me.
So, people ask me what I do, and I've never had a job. I studied for 10 years because I did a few degrees leading up to a PhD. So I'm from Guildford in Surrey. Mm-hmm. I was born in Highbury, so okay. I'm hoping we're going to be Girona tonight, but it doesn't matter, right? Mm-hmm. And I went to Durham to study theoretical physics and mathematics, and I did a four-year undergrad, a one-year postgraduate master's, and then a PhD. I studied with a guy from Athens, who was incredibly intelligent, and we, you know, kind of best friends. I never managed to visit him while we were studying together because on a trip I was supposed to visit him, I got like an insane food poisoning swimming in the sea off Corfu when we went to study there. So on finishing in the summer of 2019, on graduating, I decided I would ride to meet him. I set off on the 1st of August to go to a friend's wedding in Orléans, south of Paris. Mm. And when everyone went back to the UK at the end of the weekend, I just started cycling east. And I went to Basel at the Triumvirate border point with Germany, Switzerland, and France. Mm. And then I messaged you because I wanted to pick a nice way to go over the Dolomites. I was quite naive to riding at this stage. I'd done long distance trips before to the south of Spain because we'd always been on holiday to Andalusia in the Alpujarra, the southern slope of Sierra Nevada. But mainly they were like warm weather summer trips, and they were kind of a couple. Maximum.
And this was this in the name of a sort of post-graduation, kind of celebratory thing that you were going to sort of return to, well, you're going to resume the path you were on when this trip was finished?
Not really. In the course of my studies, particularly the PhD, I realized how incredibly intelligent all of the physicists around me were. And I was more of like a bludgeoner. I just had to study stuff for hours and hours and hours to get to the end of it. The guys around me just got insights like that. I don't know if you know much about the world of theoretical physics. You know, it's popularized in things like Oppenheimer. You know, there are these people who are just geniuses, just gifted. So I studied something called string theory, which is this very theoretical mathematical formalism for what might be the the most fundamental substrate of the universe. So it's beyond particle theory. And I spent most of my degree really just trying to understand what these kind of founding fathers did in that area in the 90s. And I realized I could probably spend a career just understanding their work. It's so advanced. And I thought, am I really contributing anything here? Anyway, more to the point, the next step after PhD studies, postgraduate positions, and my friends around me were applying for them while finishing up their PhDs. And I had one friend who applied to more than 100 to get one position in China. And it took all of my resources just to finish the degree. So I wasn't in a position to be applying for other things. So when I finished, I didn't have anything lined up in front of me. But my main thing was that I didn't want to be inside anymore. I didn't want to be sitting at a computer. I just needed to be outside. I really struggled to finish my degree because I spent so many hours riding my bike out onto the North Pennines when I should have been studying. And the last year, I even banned myself. I took my bike to London. I left it there. But then I just started hiking and said I would be hiking. Sometimes I hike like 14 hours through the night just because I loved being outside. And the slightly rogue element to my story is that I had to ask for a 3-month extension. So I was supposed to submit it in the end of August, beginning of September. And when it was obvious I wasn't going to finish, when my let finished on my last room in college, I didn't get a new one. Instead, I built this incredible shelter hidden underneath the cathedral in Durham, like right in the center of the city. It had the best view of the cathedral, better than you can get if you're on a tourist trip or whatever. My thinking was, I want to be outside right now. This is my trade-off. I'm going to be outside doing the kind of exciting camping bit. So I'm kind of already halfway doing what I want to do, but it's going to get cold quickly. It is going to force me to finish my degree. And somehow I managed to get it done by December, and I was, you know, very proud of that. But I guess that kind of started me off on a road of doing things quite unconventionally.
Even without seeing Bene's torchlit face in the penumbra of his underground or overground lair, I'd heard enough by this point to grasp that he was both highly intelligent and also someone determined or perhaps resigned to following a path that was very much his own. More meandering, yes, but also more interesting than the highways represented by societal norms. This apparently also described his journey to Albania.
When I arrived in Dubrovnik, after a month of riding, my friend who was going to visit in Athens said, I've got to go back to Shanghai for my autumn postdoc term. Come in the new year. So I spent 4 months on the beach, basically, south of Dubrovnik. Again, I found a place where I could construct a shelter. I don't know if you know that stretch of the Croatian coastline, but Dubrovnik Riviera is built up from the bottom to the top. I found this wonderful family who gave me use of their ancient olive terraces, and we picked the olives together. And actually, Croatia had its worst storm in history when I was there. So I set off in the winter, obviously a very different trip to a summer trip, and it was very slow going. It took me 2 days to get to Shkodra. I met a really great Uruguayan cyclist in Shkodra, and we cycled to Tirana together. I realized I had to fix bits on my bike by then because this guy had like top of the range Kona touring bike, which I wasn't going to be able to compete with, and I didn't want to hold him up.
Describe your bike at the time.
Yeah, I found my bike thrown over the railway fence in Durham, and I like lifted it over those horrible jaggedy metal things, right? Took it to the police station because it's like a beautiful Lance Armstrong era Trek, and left it with them, and they got back to me after a month, said nobody took it, please can you take it away, otherwise we trash it. So my bike itself has a bit of a history. Nini, I came across in the city because a doctor cycled over to us. This is the kind of place Albania is. If you're standing on a street corner with touring bikes in the city, a guy comes over and they love practicing their English. So he said, what are you guys looking for? And I said, a bike shop. And he said, don't bother with anything that Google says is a bike shop. I'll take you to the one guy who is servicing bikes at a professional level. And it was amazing, like, you know, just down a windy little street, a frosted glass window outside so you can see anything inside. And inside, the walls are just adorned with Pinarellas and Specialized and everything.
You said this is in Tirana or Skodra?
This is in Tirana, yeah. Okay. And I don't know how much more there is to say about Nini other than what I've told you in my message, but he's fascinating. He studied to be a sculptor under communism. When the communist era ended, he became some kind of investment bank or something boring inside an office and gave up after that, after 5 years, then became a bodybuilder. And then he realized his body type was more suited to cycling. So he picked that up. That's the kind of place Albania is, where something we consider quite mainstream, like cycling, would not have been, they wouldn't have had any exposure to that. So he picked it up late, but he's, you know, the best cyclist I've ever ridden with, as you saw, went to the European Championship. I stayed in Tirana for So the Tirana bit is just that because Albania doesn't, it might be changing now, but I said to him, I would like to replace my Shimano drivetrain with Shimano parts. What can we do about that? And he
what
said,
month is, what month is this? What
this
month?
Is, so I got to, I got into Albania 2nd of January, 2020. I rode down to Tirana on the 14th of January and I met Needy there and then, and my bike was only ready by halfway through February, like third week of February.
And in most places in Western Europe, the last days of February, first days of March were when people were starting to realize that the COVID thing was serious and was not going away. I mean, what can you remember? Was it those days in the, where you were as well?
Yeah, exactly. It's very vivid in my memory because having ridden through Europe, I'm sure you know most of the way, it's pretty uniform. Like the streets get a little bit dirtier when you get into Italy and then a little bit more in Croatia compared to, say, Switzerland and France, but it's still relatively homogeneous. When I crossed the border into Albania, it was like a you know, being hit, whatever the word is, hit in the senses. Like there were no streetlights, for example, immediately. So just riding in the dark and there were donkeys coming the wrong way and everything smelled different. I got to the capital city and it's quite dirty. Like there's quite a big gypsy population who kind of live in the underbelly of the city, and then but they're not hidden away. So, for example, they're walking around, kind of processing recycling, things like that. And there are police everywhere. Police just crawl the streets. Somehow, it's like an expression of power, it seems. So, when the quarantine was coming, it felt a bit like a kind of an added element of uncertainty. And when I'd been reading about how, you know, drastic the quarantines were coming in places like China, it felt like this was going to be kind of a halfway house of that. It's still relatively authoritarian in some ways, whereas I felt like in the UK it would all be doing what was right for its citizens, etc. And they were very strict with their measures quite quickly. So for somebody who, well, at that stage it was fine because I'd only been here for a year, but I would still be nervous of being confronted by the police, etc. If you're not supposed to be out on the streets, you know, strict curfew, etc. I also didn't have, so a family who lived above the cycling studio very kindly just gave me a shed to live in their garden, but I didn't have anything, so I had to go to public places for water and Wi-Fi and charge it, etc. So it was kind of like a video game in a way, kind of going out in the night trying to evade the police just to go and get the things I needed. And maybe it wasn't very sensible, but I made the decision early on to stay, and then obviously quickly you can't reverse that decision. I wouldn't have done anyway. I was fine with my mother works for the British government. She said, you've got a couple of weeks to come home, kind of, yeah, beginning of March. And I said, Mom, I was studying for 10 years. I really wanted to get to Athens, a bit like today, really wanting to get to the summit. I'm not ready to come home. Also, at that stage, it wasn't clear to me. I'd have to gotten on a plane. I wouldn't be able to ride home in that time. It wasn't clear what the risk might be to my family to get on a plane and fly home with something. It was also spreading east to west, as you know. So it got to Italy. I think it got to Iran, I think it got to Italy well before it got to the UK. And Albanian people were, they seem quite, while they're quite independent and kind of, I don't know how to, many of them didn't believe it. Many of them said, rubbish, we're Illyrians. We have the purest blood in Europe. We're the oldest civilization in Europe. It won't affect us, all this stuff. Only bad for like a month and a half in terms of lockdown. I didn't myself get sick. I don't know, the city was very heavily locked down. There was one English language journalist working in the city at the time, a lady who married an Albanian Secret Service soldier, and I communicated with her. She wrote some interesting pieces online, so it was nice to know that there were other people in the city, kind of, because at that stage I spoke nothing of the language, so I felt completely alien. So I then spent 9 months in Tirana because I was waiting for the Greek border to open, and the Greeks, because the Greeks do look down on the Albanians, plus Greece is EU and Albania is not, the Greeks let their own citizens in as of the summer or something like that. And it was a big toss-up for me. Do I try it? Do I ride to the border and see if they consider me, I don't know, European as opposed to Albanian? Mm. But actually, there was an announcement or something in August or September where the Greek government said, because we base our decisions on tourism, because it's our big thing, we evaluate our position in spring 2021. So they basically waited for the summer of 2020, realized it wasn't going to be feasible to let tourists in, and said, okay, no non-Greek citizens will enter until spring 2021. So at that stage, I had a choice to make. Do I go home? Do I spend another winter in Tirana, which I really didn't want to do because it's a concrete block? Or do I do something else? And just by chance, Nini, as the restrictions were being lifted, I mean, we could ride around from May time. So I spent the summer with the cycling group because Nini has kind of decent level riders as part of his group in the city. So we toured all around the country from Tirana as our hub. But they rode up here to the north in September to ride the pass which goes to Theth. I don't know how much you remember from your reading, but Theth is this kind of virgin valley, the last village which was still governed by this canoni, if the canon of like local law, if you read about that. I think it is the highest paved road in Albania. The Thora Pass is like 1600 meters or something spectacular, kind of hairpinny road to go up to it. So we came up here to ride it, which was great. And they went back to the city at the end of the weekend. And I just thought, why would I go back there right now and just wait for months? I really wanted to go to Theth, but at this stage, the Thora Pass asphalt stopped at the pass. You couldn't descend to Theth on asphalt. And I had, I don't know what they are, 32 mil slicks. So I wasn't about to go down on that. So I left my bike. I found this hotel in the village where my friend stayed and said, do you have a warehouse I could leave my bike? I would like to hike by to Theth by foot. So I did that and it was spectacular. I went there for a month and went up all the peaks and saw everything kind of on the edge of the tourist season, which was a real honor because it's a very different place now. And even then in the summer, it would have been busy. I came back here to the village. This is the village I've now been in for all of these years, to collect my bike at the end of that month. And the hotel offered me the chance to kind of, I don't know, it should have been a job and it was a mistake, but I kind of ended up being a volunteer for 3 years because after a couple of months, I adopted these dogs and I couldn't bear to leave them behind, even though I ended up working a 7 day a week night receptionist job from 10 p.m. till 7 a.m. and plus anything they needed me to do in the daytime, which I'm terrible with money. Like I don't live with any money in my life, but I should still have had the maturity to say, I should find a way to negotiate this being a salary position.
Where had the little, well, whatever kind of little money you needed been coming from for 4 years?
I think I'm kind of abnormal in that I genuinely don't really spend money in my life. So somebody messaged me today. The last time I can remember spending money was the Shimano drive parts in Tirana. Since then, honestly, like, we have no shops here in the village. There's nothing up here. I have really great relationships with the villagers. So for example, I'm in this space. I don't know if you can see well enough. It's a second. My friend built this great restaurant, but he didn't have the money to build the second floor. If you go around Albania at all, you'll see so many buildings have a rebar to a second floor, which is nothing. No one does anything with it. So he's given me this space where I have a bed. I have a computer, which somebody gave me, which I plug into directly to the Ethernet because the internet is very important to me. I do a lot of stuff with photography and reading and everything. And like, if I ever need anything, for example, the New Year and the Christmas period, I help them out because they're really busy. So I could be a waiter, I could be washing dishes or sweeping the floor. If I am ever really in dire need of food, these guys will feed me. You know, I've never asked them for food. It's just whenever I'm around in Albania, people want to give you food. Otherwise, I just have stores and stores of dried food, which it's difficult to explain. I don't know. Stuff just seems to come into my possession. For example, okay, this is a bit rogue. I feed the dogs from the bins here in the village, right? So there's three big hotels here in the village and they throw away a lot of meat. So the dogs, I just go and I have like a big kind of overall thing. I just go in and fish out all the food for them. And often in Albania, because there's no kind of recycling, people will leave next to the trash like a bag of pristine clothes or shoes or dry. They clear the kitchen out and all of their utensils and dry stuff is there. It is very difficult to explain. I honestly, like, when did I last buy anything? unfortunately, I fell into a cave in the mountains and I did smash my wrist, so I had to go to Tirana and have a titanium plate put in, which was something like 1200 euros. That was paid for by the hotel I did 3 years of free work for, which I sort of thought was fair because nothing else came from them. Like my mother and my brother visited me in the summer and they didn't even need to bring me anything. You must find it really difficult to relate to. You might maybe even think I'm kind of hiding something, but I just don't, like, I don't even, you know, what's really dumb is that I pay a phone contract in the UK. I've paid my Virgin phone contract for 5 years and used it. What was the point? They're not valid in Albania. So I've effectively like bought, iPhone's worth in this time and haven't used it. I think I'm quite good at not caring about stuff. So I don't care what I wear. They spend most of their money on alcohol, cigarettes, and haircuts. I cut my beard, which is a real mistake because I was freezing today in the mountains, but I never dream of going to a barber's. I just whipped it off with a trimmer, that kind of thing. You couldn't live how I live without other people's help, that's for sure. I wouldn't consider myself a sponge. Like I really don't take anything off these guys which they're not using. For example, I insist on offering Nico, the guy here, can I pay him for his power for the computer, and he just won't let me. So I don't know if I'm a bad person then for saying, well, if he's not going to let me pay for the power, shall I just leave if he won't let me pay? But they're so welcoming. Like they're constantly telling me how I'm another son, things like this. So The money thing, yeah. Like, if I need money, I have a bunch of money in bank accounts in the UK. For example, my parents have had to send me new bank cards because, of course, they expire in this time. Yeah. If I need to in the city, I can just pull money out of the wall. But just random things happened to me. Daniel, a couple of days ago here in the village, somebody crashed a drone into the top of these pine trees. And like, they're like 40 meters high, right? Yeah. And the owner of the restaurant came up to my floor and he was like, Benny, bring the ladder. We need to go get a drone. So I got the ladder. We went up to the pine tree and everyone looked at it. It was like, oh, that looks a bit sketchy. So I was like, okay, fine, I'll do it. I went up and down the tree. It was tiring and dangerous, et cetera. I got to the bottom and the guy whose drone it was said, the data on this thing is so valuable. I won't let you leave without giving you some money. And he just insisted I take 100 euros for this. This is the story of my life. Just random things happen like that. Mm-hmm. I've guided a few people on hikes in the mountains because if I could, I don't know, like close the thing out. The reason I'm still here is that for two things. So firstly, for the dogs I look after, I just can't imagine them not being with me. They've kind of changed my outlook on life. So while I was doing my PhD, if I just use doctor speak, I developed anorexia because I became so focused on basically strapping myself to my computer for as many hours as I could. I would sit there with a stopwatch. Mm-hmm. But partly because my father paid for me to do the master's, which was between the undergrad and the postgraduate studies. And it was like the only way to secure a PhD, if indeed I could get one. And I thought, if this is my last shot at continuing academia, I've got to do this 1 year as best as I can. And became quite fixated on kind of squeezing everything out of me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really realize, but I thought in the same way as like only checking the news once per day, only doing emails once a week, I kind of thought like only eating once a day and then eating less and less per day was a way of maximizing my output, which of course with something like fuel is not the answer. But you can, if you live a very lonely existence, which one does as a PhD student, I think it can become quite easy to lose your points of reference and to become very much your own master and a bit of a slave to yourself. Mm-hmm. The only way I came out of that, I was very unhealthy and very underweight, was that one day I looked, my mother said to me, if you can't find a reason to do something in life, for example, to make yourself eat, because when you have an eating disorder, somehow food becomes this enemy, basically. Maybe instead of trying to find a way to make yourself do something, look completely in the other direction, find something you really want to do and focus on that instead. And you might find it ends up helping you do the thing you don't want to do. She said, go for a walk every day, because my mother loves walking. So I started going for a walk and I just looked west one day and I saw the North Pennines. They're not Albanian mountains, but they're good enough. And I thought, I'd really like to ride to those hills one day. And I took off on my bike and I rode to Walsingham. I don't know if the Tour of Britain ever goes there. And I was completely fucked. Like I had no energy thing. And it was like a 5 hour ride to get back. And the bike just drew me in. I'd ridden a bike since I was a kid, but I'd never done like long distance road riding like that. And exercise became like, I'm lucky because I know a lot of people exercise can become addictive in itself. But for me, it was simply so beautiful to be outside and to be moving myself between A and B that food became not incidental, but I just knew I had to eat it. And it became like unembarrassing for me. It just became the thing you have to do to be able to do stuff. I still had a kind of a lot of controlling tendencies associated with that, like things like always having to wash quite well and having like a certain set of clothes I could use to sit in my bed, things like this. When I came out here, the dogs taught me somehow that none of it matters. Like they just walk around with a coat and they're just happy to see you. And they were here before I was here, obviously. So they live quite a like monotonous life if they don't have any interaction. And then suddenly someone turned up who was willing to go on walks with them, to take them home. And like the pure thrill they express without any words, just I thought was wonderful. And I stopped caring about dogs jumping up on me and touching me and being dirty and like is it, can I eat yet? Mm-hmm. Or is anyone looking at me eating, etc. It was just beautiful how basic but how somehow better their lives were than mine. That's the first reason I'm still here. But the second reason is the fact that for me it's the mountains for me are the thing. We don't have mountains in the UK, and being in the mountains here, if there's one thing I'm sure of, is that when I don't really know what my direction is, if I'm not happy on a particular day, the dogs make me smile and the mountains make me feel alive. Mm-hmm. I wish you could come and visit them. I wish the Giro could come and see them. But you'll see something of them in the south, that's for sure.
There was plenty of food for thought in that first call, but in the day or two that followed, I also caught myself wondering and fretting about what Bene had said off the bat. He was just a guy, a listener, someone who could perhaps open doors or in his case a tent flap in Albania, but not someone to be part of any story I was going to tell. Then though, I reconsidered, reread The Accursed Mountains by Robert Carver. In doing so, I realised there seemed to be something quintessentially Albanian about Bene's experience and story, and hence very valuable. That experience had been defined by a sort of voluntary material poverty, but also a richness and abundance that few of us will ever encounter. At the heart of it was a concept introduced by Carver on page 9 of his book. It was to do with hospitality, only he used a different word, besa. It seemed to be a recurring motif in the adventures of most travellers to Albania, and certainly had been in Bene's. Carver wrote, "Besa is usually translated as truce or word of honour. When a guest is accepted into an Albanian house, he is granted besa. This means his safety and honour become the responsibility of the whole fis, the extended family or clan. To allow any harm or insult to come to a guest is the deepest disgrace that can befall an Albanian. To insult a guest is to insult the whole fis. A foreigner protected by besa has an invisible army all around him. No one will risk harming him. To do so could provoke a revenge feud." I had read all of this but couldn't yet comprehend that it was a living reality rather than some arcane piece of folklore. More than this, I came to understand that it was in fact besa which, in the absence of any real law or authority, made everyday existence in Albania possible. Besa was what had brought Bene into the life of one of Albania's best cyclists, Mejdi Malhani, or Nini to his friends. But we would get to that. First, I had my annual pre-Giro call with John Foote, Professor of Italian Studies at Bristol University, who provided some valuable context on Italy and Albania's historical links. There, mainly, we talked about a relationship that for large parts of the 20th century had been characterised by a lack of hospitality on the Italians' part, also a lack of curiosity, and by exploitation.
And Albania becomes part of Italy in 1939. There's people who are forced to speak Italian. So there's, on the one hand, this kind of linguistic hybridity, but also this absolute imposition of Italian culture, Italian schools, Italian language in April 1939, that's often forgotten. I reckon if you asked 100 Italians, 99 wouldn't know anything about that. It's not taught. It's not common knowledge.
Because when we think about Italian colonization, we usually think about the east of Africa.
Libya and Ethiopia, I mean, those are the classic countries that are always mentioned, but Albania is the kind of the most colonized place of Italy, but it's never mentioned, and it's not even that much researched. It's kind of, even academics have not really worked on it. It's really off the radar, and it's quite strange that the closest place, the most invaded place, the most kind of connected place is the one that's not talked about. And I think that's what makes it so interesting that Giro is starting there, because I'd be really interested to hear all the commentaries and if they've done the, you know, if the Italians are going to acknowledge this slightly dark, well, very dark history, to be honest.
But that ended up making another podcast, which you'll also be able to hear in the coming days. It was nearly time to check in again with Bene, and for him to introduce me to Nini, the former sculptor turned bodybuilder turned cyclist turned Samaritan whose besa had kept him in Albania. Before that, Bene had continued to footnote our first conversation with things he'd forgotten to mention. Updates on his dogs, musings on the Albanians, photos and additions to a reading list that I already knew guiltily I barely had time to browse. The Albanians' veneration and fetishization of all things American, a century-long legacy of Woodrow Wilson endorsing Albanian independence from the Ottomans. The seminal or at least most famous travelogue from the Accursed Mountains, a book called High Albania, authored by the Englishwoman Edith Durham, whose journey, Bene had concluded, exemplified the tradition of besa, hospitality, humanity. Of countless scenarios in which Bene had experienced this from countless people, like the car wash attendant who, one day, ordered Bene to sit in the shade of his forecourt while he drove off in search of metal washers that Bene needed to fix the quick release on his broken bike. Of the tourist boom in Fef and the surrounding mountains, close to where Bene was living, about which he had mixed feelings. "The destruction of nature is really tragic," he wrote to me in one email. "Everything is twisted by corruption. Combine this with fly-tipping, water theft, general pollution. I'm kind of hamstrung about what I can do, since I'm one of the few who sees the damages being done in remote areas. But if I report it, which I actually have done, it almost certainly will come back to me, putting the dogs at risk." Those dogs which, in Bene's words, have shown me friendship and loyalty like I've never experienced. Not to mention their extraordinary intelligence, such, he told me, that they could out-hike him by a factor of 10. This despite the locals in the village saying the same about him vis-a-vis them. The dogs caring for whom Bene had seen as an honour, but also a heavy burden. And some of whom he had lost to guns, poisoning or theft, causing him the sharpest grief he had ever felt. The more life-affirming side of nature into which he had immersed himself in Albania, to the extent that he now dreamed of becoming a mountain guide there. An already existing pet project and pin to the accursed Alps, an Instagram-based field guide to the flora and fauna of the region, and also possibly the first ever Albanian Latin English dictionary for the relevant zoological and botanical names. How this was a refreshing antidote to his former life studying string theory, in which he had felt that he would spend a career, as he said, just trying to understand what others had produced. I felt that it was unlikely I could contribute anything unique to me, he said. One British journalist, Misha Glenny, had described Albania in 1990 as a collage of fantasies. I didn't detect anything delusional or even fantastical in what Bene had told me, but a colourful, fascinating collage it certainly was, and one that, until now, as he kept reminding me, lacked the perspective both on the country and yes, its past and future as a cycling nation, of an actual and not adopted Albanian. It was time then to finally meet the mythical Nini, at least virtually. Me in Berlin, him in Tirana, and Bene 200 kilometres to the north, in his beloved accursed mountains.
Nini, I can also reply to you here. The frustration was, and by the way, Nini, are we okay in English?
Yes, yes, no problem.
Because Daniel Nini speaks brilliant Italian, so if you want to shift to that, but I think English is fine.
No, but you not understand Italian, so we will speak in English together.
Shut up. Sounds good.
I am born from Tirana, and my origin is from Tirana. So my family is a normal family. My father was an electromechanic. He worked in the office itself. My mom, he not work at all for the moment because the father can take care to make the budget, the money budget and, for the family and to make the mother dedicated to grow me and my sister because we are two people in the family. I born in 1985 on the communism, but I not remember too much of this area because I when the communism changed, I was only 5 years old. But I have heard the story from my family because my grandfather have a good position on that time, and the family, I think it was fine. So we not have problem at all with this system. And when the system changed and the capitalism came, we start to have a lot of problem because before in Albania exist everything. Albania before was everything made was in Albania on that time. So not only in food, but also in industry. So we can have bearing or everything on that time. We have also bike on that time with the name Tirana, the bike of the city, with the name Quella in Albania is Yuli. On that time was created also the bike. And now everything was changed and the manufacturer start to become private and some people became too much rich that control a lot of people around there in Tirana and in Albania. My father have closed the life when it was 55 years old. So for that, I need to think myself for my life. And I finished the Academy of Art for sculptor. And after that, for me, it was two possibility for the work, to be a teacher. But on that time, the payment, the salary payment, it was only 250 euro. Or to give it a try, a work myself to have much more money for the life. And on that time, I start to work on the transport company. If it is a very famous transport company, it's calling Skynet. It's like a DGL in Tirana. But in the same way, my passion was the sport.
How did you, why cycling? Where did you discover cycling? Did you have a mentor, someone who introduced you to cycling? What was your, where did you get a bike? Was it a racing bike? Tell me a bit about that.
Yes, I will explain that. On that time that I was in work, before I started cycling, I was doing bodybuilding. But all of that, it was problem of economy, because following the bodybuilding make me paying more than 500 euro in a year. And I remember exactly, I think in 2008, the work on that time, my work was changed, and I remained for 2-3 months without work, and I cannot pay to follow the sport. Like a sculptor, I want to say that everything that is made by form was made from the sculptor before. And on that time, I see the bike like art. And also now, so I like too much to see a beautiful bike, and I know very well how to create the bike from beginning, from the carbon, from beginning, because I am a sculptor. So the first example always for everything, for the chair, for the laptop, for the bike, for the wheel, is the sculptor that is made it. And I decide myself to continue training, buying one cheaper bike, and to start to be a little bit competitive. I remember on the time I have bought one bike that have a cost only 200 euro. It was one French bike with the name Peugeot that is very famous also now. And it was covered by Dura-Ace, but the old model. I was working in the morning and doing cycling afternoon. On that way, I have opportunity to complete myself for everything I need to do in cycling like a sport. So I bought bike. So it was cheap on that time, but I have it. And I bought a jersey. I try on that time, it works fine to order online because it was no tax at all. And I have ordered everything, and I have the helmet, I have the sunglasses, I have the jersey, I have the bit and the bike.
What jersey was it? What was the jersey?
It was jersey for amateur made by Castelli on that time. It was in color red and black. And when I doing training outdoor, I find an old man that see me very passionate. And he stopped on the road and see me, wow, one cyclist. And he stopped me and he asked me, hello, guy, he said to me, and in what team are you? I said to him, sorry, I not have a team. I am an amateur that I am trying doing myself, training for my body and to stay fit and to be healthy. He told me, do you want that I can send to you on Tirana team? And for me, it was like a God bringing to the world this person to bring me on the team, because I was searching on that time on Tirana to find a team, and I not found it at all. The first race, it was in the main square of Tirana. It was a criterium race. But I remember it was the beginning of the season, and I was lucky when I meet the coach. I was meeting on beginning of the season, and I start doing racing directly.
Okay.
But all the race of the first years, for me, it was a disaster at all, because I was in the heavyweight. After 2-3 years, when I start to read myself what to do about the cyclist, I continue to win some race. And my better shape was when it was from 2019 to 2023, when I opened the studio. Because there I had the opportunity to work perfectly with Power, and I win on that time. I win that also Bene was there on that time. On that time, I win a lot of race.
To 2023 was not only the time window when Nini's riding career peaked, what with various top tens in national championship road races and putting Albania on the map, and also TV screens far and wide in the European Championships won by Sonny Colbrelli in 2021.
I cut out of the TV coverage the moment when Dan Lloyd, you know, the GCN commentator, Daniel, he says, a number, whatever number you were, at the back there is Nini Melhani from Albania. And look at that hairstyle. That's definitely the best hairstyle in the peloton.
It was also the phase when Nini's life pivoted again with his decision to open up his first shop, come indoor training studio, a precursor to what is now the cyclist's home in Tirana. Here, Benet would also enter his life in circumstances that Benet had already described, but on which I wanted Nini to elaborate.
In 2019, I opened the cyclist home, but on that time that I told you, I have no money to make it open. And I decide myself to do it the boss work. So in the morning, I was in the transport company. And in afternoon, I came to the studio and I start to repair some bikes to have some extra money. And I work also during the night from 3 a.m., 4 a.m. sometimes, to finish all the bike that client make me for repairing to have money. Okay. But I see very difficult because after 6 months doing like that, so all of that, it was to pay the rent, to pay the tax, then to pay everything, to pay the light, the electricity for the shop, for the studio. But after 6 months, I see that I have a healthy problem. So I start to lose the memory because I not sleep too much. So always every day for 6 months, I sleep only 2 hours, 3 hours. 1 hour, sometimes without sleeping and all, only drinking caffeine or something like that to make the body wake up. And that make me problem healthy. And later I decide to be more in focus in only my studio and to stop working in the transport company.
Can you describe, so Benet has already described to me how you guys met from his point of view. Can you remember him coming into your shop? It was the U.S. Postal track, wasn't it?
It was amazing when I met Benet on that time and when I heard this story, that because Benet, he came from Mindung by bike in Albania. And normally, like, he followed same as my passion. So he ride a lot of kilometer by bike. And not only for Benet, but we are useful. So people in Albania is creating with the culture to be too more social with the friends that have around. So, because example, in Scandinavian work different. We have a lot of friends from Denmark, but have a different culture than us. Mm. I think Albania is more friendly on that way. Mm. I don't say that the people came from Scandinavia is not friendly, but we are growing in a different culture. So, example, when we sit together on the table and some of us are eating something, we are growing with the culture to separate with each other. So we have this culture from when we are born, because people in Albania are growing with too much suffering. So, and when you know your pain, you can understand easy also of the pain of the other people. And on that way, when I see that Benet arrive by bike and he needs some help, so normally directly I start to help him. Later I have asked him for his way, and he told me that he needs to go to Turkey, but he not have arranged where to stay and where to hit. And I offer him to stay with me, and I remember we stayed together 6 months, if I am exactly. And we find the way to say thank you to each other. Example, because I was only one taking care about the studio on that time. And Benet came, and the thank you of Benet was helping me in other situations that I was not able. He create. I remember now that it used, I have also used it, what Benet have created on that time. He create a schedule that is an online schedule that every client can book it itself for training on the roller, and came without needing my help or without calling me in the phone, example, that I can come to have a free space or not. Everything now works by internet and works online for the studio that Benet have created.
So you spent the whole of the COVID, the lockdown period, living together. So you lived in Nini's house.
I'd like to interrupt Nini, because you're never going to say the right thing, because you're far too kind and far too humble. So I completely overstayed my welcome, because without hesitation on the first night, I mean, it was January 14th, so it's cold. And without hesitation, Nini says, you come and sleep in here. And I'm not very good at looking after myself. I'm not the kind of person who goes and finds a hostel. And I should be on my bike to leave the next day. I am still staying in Nini's studio 5 weeks later, which was unacceptable. But I got so comfortable, and him and his wife, Armella, insisted to feed me, to keep me warm, to give me a shower, to let me use the computer, the internet, to charge my phone, everything. And because the pandemic was coming and I was not clear about my route ahead, I did not make good decisions about, you know, planning and moving on and getting out of Nini's space, because this is his professional space, which he needs to use for his clients. And, you know, I'm not waking up in the morning and things like this. So it's really worth emphasizing this, because when Nini sort of just vaguely there said that Albanian people like to help you, this is a massive understatement, because there's no reason it should be in his nature to go to these extreme lengths to help a complete stranger, basically to let a complete stranger into his house and look after them like a child. It's completely unnecessary. And, you know, it costs him energy, it costs him time, it costs him money, but he does not even hesitate to do this for one moment. This is the same characteristic which caused him to train the 12, 13, 14-year-olds for numerous years, even though there was no, he didn't win back in any way. You know, it was a pure act of generosity. I think I maybe said to Nini before that, I think I said to you as well, Daniel, I read before I left the UK somebody saying that Albanian people were the most hospitable in the world. And that definitely has materialized to be the case, because they consider it their responsibility to defend a guest. And when I say defend, this is because Nini, I read this recently, when they had the layer jacket, the blood law, 150 years ago, if somebody was a guest in your house, they are immune from Leo Jacker. You cannot kill
someone. I've also read this.
So you took hospitality incredibly seriously, Nini, and I always felt guilty about how long I stayed. Just to clarify with the numbers, after 5 weeks, I did finally manage to get off my ass and leave. But and then the pandemic came. I found a cabin to stay in just a few hundred meters from Nini's studio. When he says we were together for 6 months, that's because I carried on hanging out with the cycling group, doing the team rides, also coming back to the studio and charging and things like that, which is not really acceptable. But I feel like it was a better relationship when I was not in his space and we could share the things we needed to share.
Nini, what do you think of the fact that Bene is still in Albania? What do you think about it?
Now he's in the Alp of Albania.
So what do you think about this?
There is a paradise of cycling, in my opinion. But so I know that what Benny said, I see that it is a very beautiful story. Eh? And no one maybe trust about that, but it is real. And I am again in the... So it's not only the Benny the example, because I am continue working like I work with Ben on that time. So I will show you another example. Now I have one guy from Colombia that he came itself that he wants to try to race in Europe. And it is neighbor with Nairo Quintana. And his coach in Colombia is one famous cyclist that is Wiener Anacona. Mm-hmm. But this guy came to me spontaneously. We not have planned together anything. So he met one other friend, and the other friend suggested to me and came to me, like in the Bene way that he met Drini and Drini bring it to me. And I discussed with him, and he explained me that he wants to try the race in Europe. But imagine, he spent more than 1,000 euros to fly to came in here in Albania. And for the moment, he's sleeping itself, he's eating itself, he's preparing for eating itself, and now he's on training. I am waiting for him because he go to train outdoor with the plan that I created. And on that time, I start to think, so imagine what sacrifice. He came from Colombia, he traveled with the flight more than 3 days to arrive here because he wants to improve himself, he wants to try itself to race in Europe. But all of these things, when we are discussing together, look very easy, but it's not easy at all, because we need to have energy, we need to trust on all of that, and we need also to spend hour of work and money to become this dream reality. I want to say about that we are made like this. We are made. Maybe we became alive to share and to help the other. No, we are not coming on that life for ourselves. In us, it's not strange to okay, in the eyes of the public, one people that sleep inside of one studio is strange. But we need to understand the situation before. We need to discuss and to have a look that people can survive and can live also on that way. So Bene, example, have 6 years living in the 5 years, I not remember exactly like this, living in the Alps alone without having any help. And I think in some way, I think he did good. Okay, in another way, he not did good because he need to be same as the other people to live in a home and not to live alone. Maybe to have friends like normally we have. Also, Bene have it, but Bene have it in his way.
In a different way, yeah.
In the end, is his life and everything was fine. And imagine, we are connected now together from Bene.
After an hour or so of listening to Nini about his life, cycling in Albania, the Giro, and yes, the Albanian culture of hospitality or besa, I, a bit like Bene a few years ago, felt that I was in danger of outstaying my welcome. It was nearly time for him to open the cyclist's home for another day of work. Before that, though, I did want to understand a bit more about what exactly the Giro might bring to Albania and its cyclists, for whom Nini currently played the role, it sounded to me, of a sort of under-supported, unhailed Pied Piper. Wearing his different hats of talent scout, coach of Team Tirana and the national team, and also the owner of Tirana's premier bike shop and training studio.
We don't need sport only for show. We need sport for culture. We need sport for kids. We need sport for grown-up people. We need sport for everyone. I understand? I don't need sport for show. But, yeah. Okay, now Giro d'Italia... is a one big event, is a big dream for everyone in Albania that now we will see is a dream like became reality. But I mean, in the way of cyclists in Albania, I think he cannot do anything. So the cyclists in Albania, after that, it will remain the same. So for that, we need to think better and to take a seat and to discuss with all of people that are involved on these things. Bringing here Giro d'Italia was the idea of the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
So before, no one of us know these things. And when I see this on social media and television, I was surprised at all, because anyone dreamed these things that in one day can be Giro d'Italia in Albania. So we have a lot of culture, because the Tour of Albania, from all this tour, it will be the third in the world, much older. We are in 100-year anniversary this year, because the first Tour of Albania was made in 1925. And now I have a big book for the whole story of Tour of Albania. But for that, we need to be in focus more to change the culture in Albania. So people, for the moment, not like to buy a bike, but like and prefer to buy a car. And we are again on this condition. Okay, the situation is not like 10 years before or 20 years before. Something is changed. And in my point of view, Giro d'Italia, it will be more in focus for marketing and publicity what in Albania is made than in the sport. So I see too much difficult. So because to push people to change idea and to change mind, to not go in the work or in school with the car, for the moment is too much difficult. It's too much difficult.
On this topic, there was clearly a lot more to say. In fact, earlier in the call, Nini had gone into detail about his frustration that the Giro organisation appears to have bypassed the Albanian Cycling Federation completely, probably reflecting priorities by liaising only with the government Ministry of Tourism. Another sore point for Nini, and major roadblock to future progress, were the seemingly nonsensical tax laws, which added 38% to the price of every bike that Nini wanted to sell when electric cars were exempt. It seemed and seems unlikely then that the Giro will catalyse an Albanian cycling boom, that soon huge chain gangs will converge on the Grazen climb, built by Italians a century ago, and therefore wisely chosen by RCS as the centrepiece of Stage 1. At the summit, there is another tenuous nod to Italy in the form of a monument to the rider sometimes referred to as the Fausto Coppi of Albanian cycling, Bilal Agaliu, who won the Tour of Albania 10 times in a row and 11 in total between 1954 and 1965. At times when reading Carver's account of Albania in the post-communism chaos of the 1990s, I wondered whether it wasn't unnecessarily hyperbolically bleak. For example, when he observed, "I felt that not only had I passed through a landscape of 50 years ago with its oxen and donkeys, hand-hoed fields and vegetable gardens, but also a terrible vision of the future, of an exhausted, broken, overpopulated world crammed with hungry, hopeless people, with the ruins of failed industrial culture all around them. All of this within 4 hours sailing distance from the coast of Italy. I was shocked. I had known it was going to be bad, but I hadn't appreciated that anywhere was quite this bad. I felt I was in a vile dream, which was impossible to get out of. It was hopeless beyond anything." This was far more extreme than any of the challenges that Nini had described to me. But it was also clear that we in the Giro were travelling to a complex place. That collage of, if not fantasies, then at least contrasting realities. Glistening waters of the Adriatic, on which the helicopter cameraman will have been told to linger. The embrace of common Albanians like Nini. But also a land still hamstrung by ancient dogmas and superstitions, present-day bureaucracy and corruption. All that remained and all that remains is for us and the Giro to see it for ourselves.
I would love to come. I will definitely, we'll find a way for us to meet in Tirana, and hopefully Benin will be there as well.
It will be perfect, and you have also the invitation from me.
Okay, thank you very much.
If you have the time and to come, you are invited by me.
Yeah, that would be great.
You'll have to do a ramp test, Daniel. So bring your bib.
I'm not sure about that.